Well, let's go ahead and get started this evening. We're in our eighth lesson in the book of Revelation and just whizzing right along. We're all the way into chapter 4 already. We're going to finish chapter 4 and get into chapter 5 this evening. So, last week we were, I think last week was Thanksgiving, wasn't it? So I hope you all had a good Thanksgiving. Last time we were together, we began chapter 4, and that, of course, is John's trip up into heaven, and it is a vision that John is seeing, and we understand that because Ezekiel had the same type of visions, and you'll see again this evening the same sort of parallels between what John sees and what Ezekiel sees and what Isaiah saw in their vision of the throne of God. And so John's vision, it's rather than being raptured up into heaven, when he hears the voice that says, "Come up here," and Jack Van Impe teaching that as pre-tribulational rapture, while it's a nice thought and a cute story, it unfortunately is not the truth. But rather, John is seeing a vision and being shown by Jesus Christ those things which are shortly going to come to pass. And that is made clear in the opening chapters. So here we have John's vision of the throne of God, and we got through verse 5 last time, and so most of verse 6, and so we need to complete verse 6. And so his vision of the throne room, and he sees four beasts around the throne, and so in Revelation 4:6, before the throne, there was a sea of glass like unto crystal. We dealt with that last time. Where in the end of Revelation we'll find that there is no more sea, that which separates the third heaven from the rest of the universe, you and I, and so that because there will no longer be a universe and a spiritual world and then a physical world that is tainted by sin. And so God won't have to keep himself and his throne and third heaven separate, so that that sea that separates us from the third heaven will no longer be necessary. So that's what that's all about. But the rest of the verse, "And in the midst of the throne and round about the throne were four beasts full of eyes before and behind." So we have description of the four beasts given by John in the next verse. So we have the four beasts, they're full of eyes before the and behind them, and so each of the beasts then has various animal and heads, and one of them has a head like unto a man. Revelation 4:7 says the first beast was like a lion, and the second beast like a calf, the third beast had the face of a man, and the fourth beast was like a flying eagle. So various and sundry of the animals. I don't know that we can garner anything in particular by making some kind of correlation. You have a beast of the field, you have a calf, which is a wild beast, a domesticated beast. You have a man, and then a bird of the air, covering all the possible places of the earth or positions in, of God's creation. I don't know that we can, that's kind of a stretch, although some have gone there, but I think that is indeed a stretch. You're looking for things that don't exist. But some of the forms, however those particular forms were chosen by God, whatever they in particular mean, it would be a true saying that Satan has indeed, we know, rebelled against God. A third of the angels went with him. At least that's we can garner that from Revelation chapter 12. We'll see that in a future study here in the book of Revelation. But meanwhile, some of these, some or all, I guess, of the forms that we find of these beasts have been used then as forms of worship made into gods. Paul warns against, for instance, the worship of angels in the book of Colossians, and the worship of things that we don't know about, don't have any idea of, and this would be one of those things. These beasts that are surrounding the throne of God. Satan, of course, has the face of a cherub, and a cherub being like a calf. And we'll find that out from Ezekiel, as a matter of fact. But that's where you get that one, because Ezekiel 10:14, we'll find out that a calf and a cherub has the face of a calf. But meanwhile, all these forms have been used at one time or another, or are still in use as gods. And all kinds of statuary and things found all over the earth. False gods, you find the calf in the Egyptian god Apis. And 1 Kings, for instance, 12:28 and 29, whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said unto them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold, thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. There, of course, the god Apis, that's exactly what was made by Aaron at the base of Mount Sinai while Moses was up speaking with God. And so that was the golden calf. And where did they get that idea? Of course, in Egypt. And the form of the calf, it didn't just, they didn't just dream that up. Hey, let's make a cow and worship a cow because we like cows so much. Believe me, I had a farmer that lived right next to me, raised cows. They stink. So, it's not as though cows are all that great, but the form of a calf had to come from somewhere, and this is where it comes from the form of the beast that were around the throne of God. Also man, the one being like the face of him, had the face of a man. Men, you think, well, where in the world do men get worshipped? Well, just wait. We're going to find a man who gets worshipped in the book of Revelation. But meanwhile, before we even get that far, Paul says men have been worshipped since time immemorial. Romans 1:23 through 25. All things at one time or another have been worshipped. Paul writes, it changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man. Right there you see it. But also other things, and to birds, to four-footed beasts and creeping things. So you have the beasts of the field, you have birds, which we're going to see here in just a minute, creeping things like snakes. The snake goes around the pole that you see at your doctor. That's a perfect example, by the way, of worship of the wrong thing, and the doctor's symbols just like that. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own heart, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. So serving oneself more than God is just another form of glorification of oneself, worship of oneself. Now there is also the Assyrian god Nisroch. You might not be familiar with that name, but it's in the Bible. And that particular Assyrian god is a false god, has the head of a and wings of an eagle. Notice, you might have missed it, but in Revelation 4:7, the fourth beast was like a flying eagle. It doesn't just have any old eagle's head, but it's like a flying eagle. So Nisroch has the head and wings of an eagle. So it's like a flying eagle. Go ahead and you know, go figure. Satan is you know, he comes up with the perfect copy of that which is in, you know, he was the cherub that covered the throne of God. He knows what's there. And so he's going to be come up with a carbon copy of that which is around the throne of God. He's not going to have some cheap second. You know, it's going to be, you know, you worship this, you know, the flying eagle. You worship the exact copy of what's in the throne room. And so here in Isaiah 37:37-38, Sennacherib, this is when the Assyrian army gets just wiped out by God. And so Sennacherib, king of Israel, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, boy, I'll tell you, his son's names, if they were any longer, they'd be completely unpronounceable, Adamelech and Sazajar, I believe is what it says, his son smote him with the sword, and they escaped in the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon, his son, remained in his stead. Obviously, the point there being that Sennacherib was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god. It all comes down to Satan worship, though. It's all about that, because that's how Satan wants it to be. And so all these are found all over the world. All these figures, all these false gods, all these statuary and what have you, has been found all over the world. But meanwhile, so we find these false gods made like unto the four beasts, and which once you realize what's going on, you say, oh, it boils down to the worship of Satan. Exactly right. Well, and besides boiling down to the worship of Satan, Betty, it also boils down to the Satan getting people conditioned to worshiping the statuary, the figures, and also not only the, like the eagle, the flying eagle, the cow. Once you become conditioned to being able to worship things that are found in nature, because we've all seen eagles, we've all seen cows, we've all seen these forms and figures. Well, one's a man, and obviously we look at each other all the time. Then it's not much of a stretch forward then to understand that also a man could then be a god too. And so, if a cow can be a god, if an eagle can be a god, if a lion can be a god, then a man also can be a god. And so, putting a figure, God, as we know him, is a spirit, and so we worship him in truth and in spirit, as it says in John. But if God is a cow or an eagle or a lion, well, then he can also be a visible man. Yeah, yeah. And so that conditions people into that understanding that we can see God. And so one of these days when a man shows up and says, I am God, and demonstrates these powers, it won't be a shock to the system. And so there you go. Satan's not as dumb as he seems, nor does he have a red tail. But meanwhile, that's beside the point. Revelation 4:8, the four beasts of John's vision all have six wings. They're full of eyes. Visions are like dreams. And so what you see is might be a little bit different than what someone else sees. The accuracy is there. The overall accuracy is correct, but there might be slight differences in the details. Not unlike, for instance, the four Gospels. The accounts that are given in the four Gospels of any particular event, for instance, what we call the Last Supper with Jesus and the Apostles. You read them, and that particular event is recounted, and each of the accounts might vary in the details that are given, because it's each of, you know, it's from four different angles, but none of them are conflicting. You know, there's no conflict between them, although not all of them give all the same details. And so here we have the same type of thing. You have six wings and full of eyes, suggesting the all-seeing quality of God. So in Revelation 4:8 and four beasts had each of them, six wings about him, and they were full of eyes within, and they rest not day and night, saying, Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, which was and is to come. And so these beasts resemble two descriptions, both Ezekiel in chapter 10 and Isaiah of chapter 6. Now, we'll look at both of these resemblances, both of the descriptions, and they're not going to fit perfectly into either, but they match both in different areas. So here in Ezekiel, notice their whole, verses 12 through 14, and their whole body, and their backs, and their hands, and their wings, and the wheels. So here in Ezekiel, the account of Ezekiel, of course, Ezekiel saw the creatures, or the beasts, actually transport the throne of God. And so they had the wheels, and how these wheels worked, I'm not certain of how they all appeared and worked, but they were full of eyes round about, even the wheels that they four had. So, and as for the wheels, it was cried unto them in my hearing, O wheel, Ezekiel says. So the wheels are something that does not appear in any other vision. Now, whether that's for one particular reason or not another, I don't know, but that's something that Ezekiel sees that no one else does. And every one, Ezekiel says, had four faces. The first was the face of a cherub. Now the cherub takes the place of a calf. And so we know from that a cherub has the face of a calf. And so we know because Satan was a cherub that he has the face of a cow. Sorry, guy. he's not a good looking guy. And the second face was the face of a man. The third, the face of a lion. The fourth, the face of an eagle. So there you have the description from Ezekiel. Isaiah doesn't go as far into detail, but he says in Isaiah 6:1-3. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. So this is a picture of the throne, just like John is describing. Above it stood the seraphims. Each one had six wings. So this is the description of the same beast. And Isaiah says that they are seraphim. And each one had six wings. With twain he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. So these seraphim are flying, and so there's two wings used to cover the face, two to cover the feet, two to fly, and there were no wheels used in their movement. And one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. So a very similar line of praise. And as John heard, and then when these beasts that John sees worship God, the 24 elders, the 24 elders that we saw earlier in chapter 3, I believe, also join in with the beasts and give, they join in worship. And that's exactly what it amounts to. I mean, we worship in truth and spirit, and according to Jesus, if we're going to worship God. And here you see a worship service. That's what it amounts to. It amounts to a worship service in heaven at the throne of God. Revelation 4, 9 through 11 says, "And when those beasts give glory and honor and thanks to him that sat on the throne, who liveth forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him that sat on the throne and worship him that liveth forever and ever, and cast their crowns before the throne, saying, Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created." So there you have a worship service, basically, that acknowledges God as the creator of all things, and that also that acknowledgement that all things that are created for the glory and honor and pleasure of God. And that, of course, includes you and I, because we are created by God for him. So that is the really the defining issue with most people. That separates, when it really comes down to it, that separates the saved from the unsaved, the believer from the unbeliever, the servant of God from him who refuses to serve. The acknowledgement that God is a creator and he has created all things, and you are his creation, and he has he is sovereign over everything, including you. And so as his creation, he owns you. And most people aren't willing to accept that. And most people aren't willing to say, you know, I am not, I don't have sovereign control over everything I do, say, and think. And you know, that if there's a God, because most people want to just, you know, flip their finger at the sky and say there is no God and I can do and think and be and whoever and whatever I want because I'm my own God. Yeah. And that's what it comes down to. Yeah, they want to be their own God. And there is no higher power than me, and that's just the way it is. And as Betty says, those people were sadly mistaken. So that really is, when you think about it and come right down to it, that's the defining difference between those who are saved and those who are not. Those who are saved have come to the realization that there is a higher power, and you are not your own. So what is said by the elders, and when you think about, you know, sit down and really think about more things, which I sometimes do. Sometimes it's in my study. Sometimes it's on the pot in the morning. Who knows where it might be? But when you think about what the elders say, that it gives testimony also to the deity of Christ as Creator and God. I mean, that's kind of a good one for the our Jehovah's Witness friends. Paul says in Colossians 1:15 through 17 that Christ is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. For by him were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones, dominions, principalities, or powers. All things were created by him and for him. and he is before all things, and by him all things consist. Well, let me just ask you a question and say, is it a conundrum? Is it a problem? Is it a and this would drive our dispensational friends crazy, because they want to neatly wrap up Jesus in a package and say that the Messiah Jesus came to the Jews, but the glorified Jesus is up there in heaven, waiting for the body of Christ to be raptured. And, the glorified Jesus didn't come to the Jews, and they want to put Jesus, they want to rightly divide Jesus. Well, let me ask you a question. Paul just said that it was Christ who is the creator of all things, whether they be visible, invisible, thrones, dominions, principalities, powers. He is before all things, and by him, Jesus Christ, do all things consist. Paul just told us that. But in Revelation 4:11, the four elders, the 24 elders, bow down before the throne and says, "Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things. And for thy pleasure, they are and were created." Who are the 24 elders speaking to? The Father or the Son? Well, before you answer, I'll tell you the answer. Because we're just about ready to flip the page and look at chapter 5. And it's immediately going to become apparent that it is God the Father sitting on the throne. And so I would tell you to always remember, I've said this before, I'll say it again, I'm sure 1,000 times before I kick the bucket and decay in the ground, always remember that there is only one God. And Jesus Christ and God the Father are two personages of that one God. And so, when Paul says that Jesus Christ was the one who created, and the 24 elders said to God the Father, "You are the one who created," they're talking about the same God. God is the one who created. And I believe I can find in Genesis the Father and the Son speaking to each other and said, We need to go down there and take a look and see what's going on. Let us make man in our image. Yeah, and then later on when those men were getting in trouble, one said to the other, "We need to go down there and take a look and see what they're doing, because I think they're getting in trouble." So one person is talking to the other, but they're both God. One God. So just as Adam and Eve were one person, they were both Adam, according to the Bible. Because by one man, sin entered. Even though we know Eve was the one who ate the fruit on the tree first. She's the one who caved first, but by one man, sin entered. So as soon as you start wrongly dividing the Bible, remember, Eve was a man as far as God is concerned, because she was Adam. So Jesus Christ is God as much as Father, the Father is God. And so don't be doing what the Muslims accuse you of and thinking there's more than one God. So God the Father is seated on the throne. Yeah, that's why the woman takes the husband's name. You're exactly right. And when a woman's takes 14 different names and keeps all the names of all the men she's ever been married to, She's, plus her maiden name, and some made-up names to be to boot. It's an abomination. At any rate, the Father holds the book sealed with seven seals. Revelation 5:1. John says, "I saw in the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book written within and on the backside, sealed with seven seals." All right. So we have a bit of a mystery. There's a book sealed with seven seals. So we don't know what it says, but we have a clue because we're reading the Bible. And we can look elsewhere in the Bible and look at similar books and similar experiences, and we find a book in Ezekiel's experience, which is very similar to what John is looking at. And Ezekiel chapter 2, verse 9 and 10, Ezekiel writes, "When I looked, behold, a hand was sent unto me, and lo, a roll of a book was therein. And he spread it before me, and it was written within and without. And there was written there lamentations and mourning and woe." So, lamentations, mourning, and woe. Nothing cheery at all. Nothing all that great. Lamentations, mourning, and woe. Well, he is told, Ezekiel is told to eat the book. I'm sure you've read the book of Revelation before and are familiar that John in chapter 10 is told to eat the scroll. And that the scroll tastes like honey, but it turns sour in his belly. Well, Ezekiel's told to eat the book so that he can prophesy and he'll be able to speak to Israel. Ezekiel 3:1 through 3 says, "Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, eat that thou findest, eat this roll, and go speak unto the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that roll. And he said unto me, Son of man, cause thy belly to eat, and fill thy bowels with this roll that I give thee. Then did I eat it, and it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness." So the only difference was that it did not turn sour in his belly. So there is a difference, but it's a very similar experience. And what it was filled with was lamentations, mourning, and woe. So we can take a stab in the dark and a little bit of a guess that there is some lamentations, mourning, and woe in the book that is sealed with seven seals. And we also, since I've read the book of Revelation, I have a cheat sheet. I know that the opening of the seals also does one other thing. It contains actually almost the entire contents of the book of Revelation. And so it brings us to the end of the world. So as we open the seals, the last seal from the very first seal to the seal to the last seal spans the chapters from 7:1 all the way to 22, chapter 22, verse 21. So the contents of the book that are being held by God the Father, that is sealed with seven seals, spans almost the entire book of Revelation. Now, we know that the book of Revelation is not just lamentation, mourning, and woe, but also the institution of the kingdom and salvation and that. So the book and the seals covers quite a long period, and it covers quite a span of events, of which we'll look at, but not this evening. I just want to kind of throw that out there that we do know that before we get to that point. Now, notice, if you would, in Revelation 5:1, that the book that he's holding is a book written within and on the back side. So it's written on both sides. Now, that is also found on Ezekiel's book. So you have that in common. So the book that Ezekiel had was the same way. It was written within and without. Ezekiel 2:10. It was written within and without. And so that is very uncommon at that time. You know, we have pages that are written on both sides, but that was very, very uncommon at that time. And it's called an opistograph. That opistograph represents the divine fullness of knowledge and God's counsels, and also his foreknowledge. So there is a reason for that writing on both sides in both instances. Now, there are seven seals, and if you haven't caught on quite yet, seven is already cropped up quite a few times. You know, there's been seven of this, seven of that. There's been seven candles. There's been seven seals. There's seven of a lot of things. And there's going to continue to be seven, this, that, and the other thing. But the seven represents completion, completeness, fullness, perfection. And so it is with the seals. When Daniel was given information by the angel, the book that he was given was sealed, and he was told to seal the book, that the information was not for that time, that it was for the time of the end. Now we run into a book that God is holding, and it has seven seals, so we can learn something by the number of the seals, that it is perfectly sealed. It is completely sealed. So it's not partially sealed or somewhat sealed. It completely hidden from every human eye. There is no understanding it at all until it is revealed. And so we read in Revelation 5:2-3, and I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof?" And no man in heaven, nor in earth, neither under the earth, was able to open the book, neither to look thereon. So there's your answer. No man anywhere, heaven, earth, under the earth, over the earth, out in outer space, no man is able to open the seals. It's completely and perfectly sealed. And so it is a complete mystery. So when we think about mystery, like for instance, when Jesus spoke about the mystery, when Paul spoke about the mystery, there is, in fact, a reference of mystery, because mystery is something that's hidden. And this is the mystery, perfectly hidden until it's revealed. And so until all the seals are unsealed, until they're all taken off and broken away, it's completely hidden. And so it can't be revealed until that time. Now, in all of human experience, you have generally pessimism. I know in recent years, well, even not just recent years, but you can think about, for instance, from 1970, in the 70s, I can remember Time Magazine or Life Magazine, one, it must have been Time Magazine, proclaimed we were going to have an ice age because the temperatures were going to plummet and we were all going to go into an ice age. And then in the 80s, scientists declared we were going to have global warming. And so there was a big turnabout. And so throughout the years, it's gone back and forth, and now it's climate change and this, that, and the other thing. But the general consensus by secular science and government and all that has always been a pessimistic outlook for humankind. One of the things that science has looked to do is to try to find a way to populate another planet, Mars, build an outpost on Mars or some other planet so that the human race could then go there and start an outpost where we could populate another planet, because certainly the day is going to come where all the humans are going to destroy themselves, either by nuclear war or global catastrophe, or we're going to burn ourselves up by carbon dioxide, or freeze ourselves, we're going to ruin the planet somehow. And you've all heard at one time or another, this is the only home we have, and we're going to cook ourselves or pollute ourselves to death. I can remember the pictures of all the trash in the ocean, and we're polluting the planet, and just everything under the sun, and whatever the case might be. But it's always a global pessimism that we're killing ourselves. And at one time, it was the population of the planet, if we ever got to 7 billion people, the Earth couldn't possibly sustain that many people. We'd all starved to death, and of course now we're over 7 billion people, and I ate dinner this evening, and probably ate too much. That's not to say there aren't people who are starving in this world. There most certainly are. But the fact of the matter is not because of a lack of food. I also read recently that we have to throw away most of the cranberry crop because we produce too many cranberries. So if you need cranberries, buy them, because they're going to have to throw them in the dump. There are so many cranberries and no one to buy them while people in part of the world starve. So, that's the problem in the world. There's plenty of food. It's just in the wrong places. So but this pessimism springs from secularism. It springs from a lack of knowledge about the Creator. And it springs from not understanding that human history and destiny rests, as verse 1 says, in the right hand of Him that sat on the throne. In the right hand of Him that sat on the throne. So in other words, our destiny is in the hands of God. God has the ultimate sovereignty over all things, not just our personal lives, but over the entire universe. This planet, everything, good and evil, and all things, seen and unseen. John knew that. And so when he looked and no man anywhere could unseal the seals, John was grief-stricken in the vision. It was like having a bad dream. Here's the book with the answers and the fate of man hanging in the balance, and no one can open the seals to find the answers. Here's God's plan of redemption, God's great destiny for all the universe, and no one can open the seals to read the book. And John sees this in his vision and is completely grief-stricken by what he sees. And so in Revelation 5:4, John says, "And I wept much, because no man was found worthy to open and to read the book, neither to look thereon." Well, I understand his grief. I understand the problem, the conundrum. But one of the elders, Revelation 5:5, saith unto me, "Weep not. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof." So here we have one of the great triumphs of the Bible, one of the great triumphs of all history. And this is what we worship and celebrate when we think about our Lord Jesus Christ. So when we, rather than thinking of Jesus as, here he was the Messiah that came to the Jews in his earthly ministry, and now he's the glorified Jesus up in heaven, the thing we need to do is how does God reference ideas? How does God present ideas of people and places and things and himself and his Son Jesus Christ? That is what's important. How does God present these things to us, and how do we understand them in light of how he presents them? Instead of trying to understand them in our own light, maybe understanding them in his light would be the better idea. For instance, the New Testament is, in fact, the prophetic fulfilling of many of the prophecies that were made in the Old Testament. And when I say the New Testament, I'm including the writings of Paul and ultimately the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation will be the winding up of all of the prophecies of the Old Testament, ultimately. But here we find in Luke 4, verse 16 through 21, the prophecies spoken of by Isaiah in Isaiah 61, verses 1 and 2. And Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up for to read. And there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." And he closed the book and gave it again to the minister and sat down, and all the eyes of them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began to say unto them, "This day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears?" So What Jesus was saying was that as he stood there, the prophecies of Isaiah 61, 1 and 2 were indeed fulfilled. And so when we think about Jesus Christ, we can't think about one Jesus in one time and one Jesus in another time, but rather he is the same today, yesterday, and tomorrow. But he is the one who is God's choice to fulfill the prophecies that have been put in place for a long, long time. Jesus Christ is, in fact, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, as was said by the elder in Revelation 5:5. That was spoken of long, long time ago in Genesis 49:9-10. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. There is so much there, so much there to understand that is not understood, but it tells the story of Jesus Christ. It tells the story of how long he's going to reign in the kingdom, in the earthly kingdom, in the 1,000-year reign, and when he's going to turn the scepter over to his father. And and that is absolutely true. Even Paul says, when Shiloh come, when peace comes, that is when Jesus then is going to be done with everything that he is given to do. Because, for instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 24, then cometh the end, when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and all power. When peace comes, when he puts down all human rule, authority, and power, that's when Shiloh comes. That's when he turns over the kingdom to God the Father. Jesus Christ is the root of David. Isaiah 11:1. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The verses that follow, which we're not going to read this evening, Isaiah 11:2 through 9, a vivid picture of the king and his kingdom here on earth. But it's not just individual spiritual salvation, my friends. John, when he was thinking about what was on the line as he looked at this book with the seals, knew the messianic promises. And besides the spiritual salvation, which he knew all about, also was thinking about the physical salvation in the kingdom and the promise of peace, the promise of security, a place for the people of God, that they would be assured of a place with God, as Isaiah 11:10 speaks of. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. So, John's initial grief, very understandable. If Christ had not prevailed over the forces of evil that sought to destroy him. You see, Revelation 5:5 said, "The root of David hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof." He prevailed, my friends. That means there was things trying to stop him from becoming the one that could open the seven seals. The Lord Jesus Christ took human form and the human nature to destroy the power of Satan. Hebrews 2:14 and 15 said, "For as much then as the children are partakers of the flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is, the devil, and deliver them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage." Christ rose from the dead, defeating and condemning nature, the nature of the law. You see, the law condemns. It doesn't help. It condemns. And so in Colossians 2:14 and 15, Paul wrote that Christ blotted out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. Having spoiled principalities and powers, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it. And as I just read in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 23 through 26, then the last enemy that's going to have to be destroyed is, in fact, death itself. That's why we look forward to what we call eternal life. Paul says, "Every man in his order, Christ the first fruits, afterwards they that are Christ's at his coming." By the way, the only coming that we can find is the coming at the end. But we'll deal with that later. "Christ at his coming, and then cometh the end, when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. For he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death." So there you have the outline for the agenda. Jesus Christ at his coming has one big job left to do, and that is to destroy death. And so we know what it is that Jesus is going to have to do when he comes. So meanwhile, we see what John is seeing in the throne room. And next time, we'll see what else is said about the throne of God.